This episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes, changing how you see the network. Thousand Eyes shows you details of networks you don't own, such as the internet. Find out more at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. This episode of Packet Pushers is brought to you in part by Manage Engine Firewall Analyzer, agentless log analytics and configuration management software that supports over 50 different firewall appliances. Visit www.fwanalyzer.com/packetpushers and get a free 30-day trial.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the greatest data networking podcast ever invented in the known universe. Oh, maybe not. Today is a wide-ranging discussion with somebody that I've been, well, never met in person, but widely seen over the Twitters. He's been ensconced inside a large corporate organization which doesn't encourage you, while you're in corporate slavery, to actually speak out loud. Because even though you might have your own opinions, they're still the company's no matter what you do. So Ethan and I are chatting today to Wes Felter. Welcome to the show, Wes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So maybe give a bit of a précis of whatever it is you want to tell us about where you've been for the last 15 years and what makes you sort of interesting to packet pushers.
Yeah, thanks. So I've been in IBM research for about 15 years. I just left recently. That's my whole career. And I did different kinds of research for a number of years. A lot of it was power management, nothing to do with networking. But then around 2010, I started to see academic work on data center networking that was really interesting to me. And also, IBM got into the networking business, so they encouraged us to get into networking research. So I started looking at what was going on in networking at that time, which was OpenFlow and SDN. And I really got into that. So for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, I've been working on networking research in various, you know, flavors. A lot of it is, you know, data center fabrics and network virtualization and cloud networking. And so, and I've really enjoyed doing that kind of work. You know, it's also brought me into contact with people like you guys, the packet pushers. You know, I've learned a ton because I have a different kind of an unusual background. You know, a lot of the packet pushers and people that I sort of meet in the networking world, you know, they have many years of experience, and it all started with really Cisco, right? Which makes sense because they were really dominant. They set the architecture for the whole industry for many years.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you put all that past tense. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I have a different view of the world. You may say that it's a totally warped view of the world, right? Or you may say that it's a future looking view. You know, maybe it's looking towards a future that will exist, and maybe it's a future that will not exist. We'll find out. But I never learned any of that stuff. I never learned the CLI. You know, I never learned OSPF. You know, Greg was talking earlier about, you know, token ring, source routing, things like that. I don't know that stuff.
That's how he networked his house, was all token ring, pretty sure.
It'd be fitty if it was anything. It wouldn't be token ring.
But you never learned OSPF, though, Wes? I mean, you really went all out with the OpenFlow and SDN and, you know, building forwarding tables that way as opposed to what I would call traditional networking, distributed routing protocols.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I never learned that stuff. And I started kind of from scratch, just thinking, okay, we have this hardware. I know what it's capable of. Fortunately, we were able to, you know, to talk with Broadcom, and, you know, we had access to their stuff under NDA. We were able to talk with vendors. We were a switch vendor, so I was able to talk with our NOS people. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, I could see the requirements coming from the cloud. I could see virtualization was happening. Mm-hmm. And so I just, yeah, we were trying to kind of reinvent networking almost from scratch, kind of in an ideal way, ignoring all the legacy that had been done before. You guys probably know there's good and bad aspects of that. Like, you get a fresh viewpoint, but at the same time, you may be reinventing things that you don't need to reinvent.
Yeah. So you did a lot of work with OpenFlow, and, you know, we were just before we pressed the record button here, we were chatting about why OpenFlow was really popular for a while and then seems to have faded away. We don't see people talking about OpenFlow, and yet there are ways we could have used it with OpenFlow that would work, but nobody could sort of get their mindset around that. So you got into OpenFlow because it made sense to you?
Well, actually, so in retrospect, the real reason we got into it was because we thought that that was really the only path to be able to innovate in the network. Hmm. Because if you look at what the state of the network was at that time, basically it was, you know, hardware-defined networking. You bought a switch, it came with a NAS on it, you did not get to choose the NAS, and if you wanted to write your own NAS, like, say, Arista, which is a company that came up around that time, and really Arista is a NAS company, not a switch company, right? Their switches are mostly commodity, but they had to design new commodity switches just to run their NAS. They couldn't just take off-the-shelf switch because that didn't exist at that time.
And the NAS included the apps. So you had your BGP routing app, your OSPF app, and your CLI, and your SNMP, and your, that was all. But it was all sold as one thing. You bought the switch, the NAS, and all the apps. And if you ever wanted to upgrade the apps, you were forced to upgrade the NAS, and most of the time, even the hardware as well.
That's right.
Right. So, and yet, what's becoming clear now is that that's not the way it's going to work out in the future. But you had that picked up around 2010.
Yeah. I mean, if you looked at, for example, academics and, you know, grad students, who it would be one or two or three people trying to do some new innovative project, they couldn't create a NAS, obviously. So sometimes they would go work for Cisco and they would add a feature, you know, to iOS, or maybe they'd go work for HP and add a feature to their NAS, or they would do something.
10 years of solid effort.
Right. Or maybe they would do something in a simulator, you know, that wasn't in a real network. And then OpenFlow came along and it promised this separation between the control plane, which is now running on a regular server, which you could write yourself in any programming language you want to. And there are a ton of OpenFlow controllers in Python, Ruby, Java, you know, any language you can imagine. And there's a lot of open source there as well, because that's the other thing, is in this old world, nothing was open source, right? I mean, open source like Quagga existed, but you couldn't run it on an actual switch.
No, it was hard to break into those switches. You couldn't just, you know, crack it and say, okay, now that I've broken into this thing, I can load whatever I want. It was way harder than that to get that done. So right.
And so the only thing we had was OpenFlow. And there was this idea that, okay, the switch vendor will give you the ability to control the flow tables in the ASIC using OpenFlow. And then you can put your innovative stuff into a controller. So let me just give you one example of what we came up with there. You know, at the time, people wanted L2 fabrics in the data center, things like Trailer SPB. And of course, it took the NAS vendors many years to implement that, if they ever did. Many of them gave up. And then when they did implement it, often it was an enhanced license that cost thousands of dollars. Seemed like a disappointment to me because I, you know, when I saw Trail, I thought, oh, great, you know, we can finally replace Spanning Tree with something better.
Yeah. For example, Cisco monetized that with Fabric Path. They sold that. It was an upsell and it was enhanced. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, Trill standard. It was Trill Plus. And it wasn't cheap. And then, as you say, ironically, they gave up on it. But
Well, I think the market actually gave up on it first and then the vendors kind of followed. And that's due to overlays.
Well,
but
yeah, that's right. Well, what they did was they charged extra for Trill. That was, we've talked about that. It didn't work very well. So like all Cisco code, it's released too early. It's not properly tested and validated. So when it actually came to market, it didn't work very well. There was a lot of bugs. And the Trill implementation wasn't completed. Like they hadn't sort of worked their way. The IETF, you know, just pushes stuff out. And it doesn't necessarily work properly by the time it's reached the end of the drafts phase, right? So it might take another 3 or 4 years for people to work out what all the corner conditions are. So you've got this worst sort of thing where Cisco's way of implementing features is to slap them together, push them out, and see if anybody's using them. The IETF has got something that's kind of working and is near enough and good enough, so we'll just publish that and see if anybody picks up on it. And then Cisco says internally, we have to make money from the effort to develop this feature, so we're going to add a license onto it. And so ultimately, the way I view it is Trill died because everybody was doing it wrong.
Right. Although if you think about doing it right, it may have taken them so many years to do it right that they would have lost money on it or something. Anyway, so we actually were able to implement kind of a simplified subset of Trill in an OpenFlow controller that worked with existing switches. And we called that per address spanning tree or PAST, because basically for every MAC address, we just computed a separate tree over the network. And we were able to use all the links. So each MAC address had a spanning tree that could only use, you know, some subset of the links. But because each MAC address had a different tree, we were able to spread traffic across all the links. You could think of this like per VLAN spanning trees, because you know, you guys know about that stuff. I didn't really know about it because I didn't know anything about traditional networking.
Sure.
But
operating in isolation. Right. Okay. Yep.
But we did it for every MAC address. We created a separate spanning tree, and we were able to do this in a fairly simple way in an OpenFlow controller. And so that was pretty cool. We were positive about that. Unfortunately, then the reality started to set in. This was destination-based forwarding. So basically, it was pretty simple, right? For every MAC address, you would have one flow entry.
Yep.
It just says, if the destination MAC is this address, you know, go this direction.
And that was the flow state that you were in programming.
Right. And basically, that's the same kind of flow state that you would have in a normal L2 network, right? You have one entry per MAC address. So to me, this is how OpenFlow should be used. That basically, you know, you come up with this efficient flow state and then you load it in there. And I think we loaded it all preemptively. So when a new MAC address appeared on the network, we would just calculate the whole tree. We would load the entries into all the switches. And that way then, sort of at runtime, there was no OpenFlow control traffic. Everything was full speed.
Pre-programmed. The tables were calculated. There was no way that there was traffic would always match the rules. There was no reactive. It was all predictive.
Right, because reactive can really kill your performance. And you can essentially perform a denial of service attack against your own controller if you have a lot of flow setups and stuff.
And that was something that we did many years. So in the old days, we used to have process switching and cache express forwarding or cache path. And if we had too many new packets arriving on a router, that would then pump them up to the to the CPU to be calculated for putting a cache entry into the router or the switch, then the CPU would die.
Right.
So it's funny how that particular feature has always been around in networking. And we always knew about it. And we lived with it for 10 or 15 years before we got rid of it.
Yeah.
Wes, in this case, you're talking about new MAC addresses appearing on the wire, having to react to them, the controller having to compute a path and then load a load an entry into the forwarding on the switches, and that taking too long. I mean, switches that see that natively, you know, as a MAC address goes by, they populate their bridging tables. That happens more or less instantly as the frame is being forwarded. In this case, you're talking about all that back and forth of the controller to sort that out running an algorithm, which is a performance penalty that is unsustainable at any sort of meaningful scale, especially if you've got MAC addresses coming and going on the network.
Well, I think it was fine. It was just a few milliseconds per MAC address. So it was pretty good. But even that, actually, I think was a little bit outside the mainstream of OpenFlow. The way a lot of people wanted to use OpenFlow was they wanted to match on like the whole packet header in every flow rule.
Yeah.
And so they ended up creating millions of flow rules.
Yep.
And
so they wanted to specify the source IP, the destination IP, the source port, the destination port, and the input port and the output port and the
Right.
And that's not how we worked, right? Well,
that's the thing. So there's a lot of cases where, you know, just destination-based forwarding is fine. Almost all cases, right? The world pretty much runs on destination-based forwarding.
That's what IP routing is.
Yeah.
You know, the internet
runs on it.
Yep.
You know, Ethernet runs on it. So innovation is good, but you don't want to go crazy. I think it makes sense to look at that, you know, to really look at the problem of, you know, what you're trying to solve and what's the simplest way to solve that. Anyway, so then we wanted to start doing other things. Like, our first version of PAST didn't support VLANs, okay? Which is pretty lame, right, compared to real networking where you actually do have VLAN support. So we started looking at how to do that in OpenFlow. And again, if you just have one flow table, which is the way that OpenFlow 1.0 worked, you would have to have combinations of rules that would explode the number of flows. You end up with n squared or m times n kind of flows if you have, you know, m VLANs and n MAC addresses. And it just wouldn't work. And if you look at the way the actual ASIC works, which again, we were able to do because we got the documentation, there's not one big flow table or one big TCAM inside the ASIC. And this is something that I think is important to understand. There's actually maybe a dozen or two dozen tables in the ASIC that are in series. And I'm not giving away any secret sauce here.
No, this is TCAM, binary CAMs, L3 CAMs, and ternary CAMs.
Well, there's different types, and also there's there's just different tables. You know, the first thing that you hit when you come into the ASIC is a VLAN table that takes care of, you know, untagged, tagged, port-based VLAN, stuff like that.
Yeah, then L2 you maybe stuff, have an
L2, then you have maybe an L2 table, then L3 table, then maybe you have to do L2 again, and then you have things like ECMP. So you have all these tables, and we could see that all that was there in ASIC, and a traditional NAS has used it. In fact, honestly, the Broadcom ASICs kind of look like somebody took the IEEE and IETF specs and basically put them in silicon, which I guess makes sense.
Probably what people, they did do, actually, yeah.
You know, people are going a different way now with programmable stuff, but at the time, basically, they wanted to be compliant with these standards. They put them in silicon. Great. But OpenFlow 1.0 only gave you this one table, and some people tried to do things where they would take a rule and they would kind of try to pick it apart in the switch and put it into different tables. So a natural way to do this is to just really expose what the ASIC actually was to the control plane by making OpenFlow have multiple tables and exposing each of these ASIC tables as an OpenFlow table, and then allowing a packet to basically, you know, match a certain rule in one table and then go to another table. Each table would match just some of the fields. So we started working on this. The specs were all written, but then none of the NAS vendors really implemented them, because I think there was this trap where they had implemented OpenFlow 1.0, which was not a huge amount of work, and nobody really used it in production. You know, there was a bunch of research, stuff like what we did, you know, that was not a product, but there was not a lot of products that were shipping based on OpenFlow. And so there wasn't this customer pressure saying, yeah, we really want the better OpenFlow in the next version of the NAS. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was customer pressure for other features, because there's always new stuff that customers want. And so OpenFlow was kind of backburnered. And I think this idea of, you know, the switch vendor and the control plane being like separate companies that were going to interface through this standard, it really just didn't work, because there was nobody to like crack the whip and make this stuff happen. And I think if you look at the company that has really been successful with OpenFlow, in my mind, it's Big Switch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what they did, I don't know what they did in the early years, because it took them quite a few years to get to market.
Yes.
That, you know, the first version that they shipped publicly was called Big Switch 3.0. So I don't know what happened to 1.0 and 2.0.
They solved the scaling problem before a lot of other people had, as kind of my memory as we go back in time. Yeah. That was
they figured out a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. They figured out that if you wanted to program a data center network just like you do today, you use very coarse grain flows.
And then destination-based forwarding.
Destination-based forwarding, number one. That was the first thing they got into. And then they realized what you've highlighted, which was the ASIC was a problem. You had to work with the ASIC architecture that you had. So then they started carving the rules up into rules that can use L2 CAM, rules that can use L3 CAM, and rules that need to use TCAM. And then working out how to optimize the rules so that you don't exceed the capacity inside of the Broadcom Trident chipset.
Yeah, but I think the key thing they did is they created their own NAS. They did not try to build a controller that can work with the HP NAS and the IBM NAS and all these others.
And it was a NAS that was optimized for them, very light, basically just an arbiter between their controller and populating tables.
Exactly. And that's kind of what you need if you want to make OpenFlow successful. But then you're in kind of an interesting situation where now that you're in control of the NAS, you don't have to use pure OpenFlow, right?
Yeah.
You can actually, because OpenFlow has this idea that all of the smarts is in the central controller. And a lot of people have pointed out, you know, yeah, this was tried decades ago, you know, there's problems. You really want some functionality to be down at the switch, maybe even down in hardware. You know, the ASICs have hardware MAC learning, which in many cases has to be disabled in OpenFlow, and you have this much slower learning process, as we talked about earlier. So once you're in control of the NAS and the controller, now you can really open it up and you can think, well, let's not restrict ourselves to OpenFlow. Let's just think about what's the best place to put functionality and just put the functionality there, and what's the best protocol. And let's have a protocol that
Create an API that actually does exactly what we need it to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't need to do MAC learning or IP forwarding, or you just have it optimized for the task that they want to undertake. Okay, that would make sense. I mean, Big Switch doesn't talk about how they do their code internally, or they haven't done much publicly, but I do know that they went on to say, you know, we have to optimize our controller to use what features are available in the silicon.
Right. I think the features that are available in silicon is not a problem because they're actually pretty good. But yeah, it's really the architecture. So, and a key thing here, by the way, of the reason why Big Switch was able to write their own NOS, and the reason why we have an explosion of new NOSes coming out today, we have Facebook, Microsoft have their own, you know, Dell has their old legacy one, and they have a new one that's pseudo open source. We have, you know, all these startups coming up with new NOSes. It's because Cumulus really kind of broke this open with Oni, that they came out with disaggregated networking, basically, where, you know, you get the white box switch from one vendor, it comes with no NOS. Oni is a standard interface that lets you boot your own NOS on it. So once that came out, I realized, oh, hold on, I don't now have to make my own switch. You know, I don't have to do all this stuff. And the NOS is really not that black magic. It's really Linux with a couple processes on it to control the ASIC. It's so, also, I think a lot of people, including myself, thought that writing a NOS was much harder than it was. I think Cumulus, partly it's because they did a lot of work and open sourced it that made things easier, but also they just showed that it's not an impossible project. That caused me to really rethink OpenFlow completely, to the point of maybe we should start with, on one hand, we have this white box switch and we have the ASIC and we have the ASIC SDK, which unfortunately is still kind of under NDA, but now we have the switch abstraction interface, or SAI, that's coming out.
Yeah. And so we also have the new silicon coming from Cavium and Barefoot, which
programmable chips.
It's so, less of a secret.
Exactly.
Know, it's not a secret club anymore.
And then, on the other hand, you have what you actually need to do with packets. And in between, you can now do anything you want. And I think anything you want is unlikely to be OpenFlow. I think it's more likely to be something intent-based.
Yes. I think ultimately what you crashed onto is the fact that the networking industry doesn't change. The idea of updating your NOS to an industry that spent 30 years buying monoliths was probably so foreign that, you know, that was a problem. And then saying to them, well, you don't need spanning tree, you don't need MPLS, you don't need, you know, VLANs, you don't need any of this because we can take it all in the programming of. And ultimately that led to, you know, there was always going to be a big resistance to it because everybody was going to do it the way they'd learned from Cisco.
Yeah, that's true. Although fortunately, I was in the cloud, you know, kind of looking at things from the perspective of a cloud provider. And so people there are more willing to take risks. You know, definitely there's legacy. So that's another lesson that we looked at from OpenFlow is we made a list. We actually thought about, okay, if we were going to actually make a real controller that performed all the functions of traditional networking, we made a list of what those protocols and functions needed to be, right? STP, LLDP, LACP, you know, just all the P's, right?
Some of which don't even make sense to really implement in a controller, you know, that far away. You want them to happen right up front.
But again, we couldn't, right? In OpenFlow, everything had to be in the controller. And so, yeah, we were going to be sending out, you know, all the STP beacons and all the LLDP beacons and everything from the controller over a management network through the switch and then out the data ports, which was just going to be very chatty.
And that's where it all starts to come unstuck.
Yeah, we thought about implementing all of these different protocols and their state machines in the controller. And there were some awesome things about it because the entire network would now look like one big switch, which is why that company is named what it is.
Right. And,
exactly.
And if we ever got around to implementing routing like OSPF and BGP, the entire network, the entire fabric would be one router. It would have, you know, one AS.
Yep.
It would be great. But we just looked at the amount of work that needed to be done to implement all of these protocols, and man, it was an enormous amount of work.
It's funny now, you could probably, what Cumulus has done, of course, is they're implementing a lot of those protocols, LLDP and MLAG and all that, into Linux, like as...
Right, so that's another clever thing they did, is they reused a lot of open source. They used the Linux kernel, and they used Quagga.
And they And they've gotten together with other people who've written LLDP and all those modules that we use for Ethernet signaling.
Right.
You know, done some testing and put some people behind them to fix up the bugs that are in them. And then, but you're generating all of those elements locally in the switch. You're not doing it from the controller.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, we thought about trying to rewrite the entire world with OpenFlow, and it was pretty daunting. We decided not to do it.
Yeah. And that's when you start to get disillusioned with OpenFlow. You thought this is just way too difficult.
Well, it's needlessly difficult, because by this time, I guess this is 2013 or 2014, disaggregation now existed, and we realized, hey, you can run Linux on a switch, you can run normal Linux packages and daemons. So I actually built a Cumulus network in 2015 to try it out, because I'd read a lot about it, but I wanted to actually learn it, and so I built it out in our lab, and we used Cumulus for the switches. Cumulus is based on Debian. And then on the servers, we had Ubuntu, which is also based on Debian. And it basically looked like the same thing on both sides. So for example, we talked about LLDP. We literally used the same LLDP daemon on the switches and on the servers.
Yep.
So that when I would do debugging, I could log into either side of a link and I could do LLDP CTL. That command in Linux, and the output was the same format. It was not like switches were in one world and servers were in a completely different world. It was now the same world. And I
used Cumulus had to get over that network. I bet you found out that, I'm going to cut you off here a little bit, but apologies, that network engineers weren't willing to run Linux commands to do their thing. I mean, Cumulus's hardest fight has been convincing network engineers that typing at a bash shell is a perfectly acceptable way to do business.
Yeah, I'm sure they did have that problem. So this gets back to my very unusual background where, to me, I don't care. I don't even know the CLI, the network CLI. So to me, making a switch into Linux makes perfect sense. I understand that to 90% of network admins out there, it does not make sense.
Mm.
So again, this is the question of, is this the future and it's just Cumulus got there a little early, or is this not the future? And I don't know that. I kind of would like it to be the future, as a server person and also as a kind of person who wants to break down silos. I like the idea that someone could manage servers and switches without having to have a lot of specialized knowledge.
ThousandEyes, our sponsor today, says that they change how you see the network. And as someone who's spent many hours with their product, that's not just a tedious marketing claim from yet another monitoring company. Rather, ThousandEyes gives you insight into the parts of the network that you don't own, but that your critical services run across anyway. Imagine being able to monitor in detail the internet between you and your customers, or between you and your SaaS providers. With ThousandEyes, you can do exactly that. You will be able to see every individual router between you and the target you're monitoring, along with a historical view of the BGP state, alternate paths, as well as latency and loss metrics all across the internet, that network you do not own. The monitoring tests are run via ThousandEyes cloud agents, enterprise agents that you place at useful spots in your infrastructure, or on endpoints like laptops. So you can get a true end-to-end graph of a path no matter where it starts and ends, inside your network or outside of your network. You can go up the stack as well, do things like track CDN performance, look at DDoS attack and analyze it, check out DNS server errors, look at issues within your ISP's network using internet outage detection, which is a really cool ThousandEyes feature. You can measure mean opinion scores for VoIP paths and do in-depth web transaction monitoring to find out why that web server really is slow. And all these features are available through an intuitive interface that you drill into to get right to the root cause of the problem. When the root cause is spotted, you can then create a shareable report, which is really handy when you want to share what you found with that upstream third party that you might not have a business relationship with. If you are interested in ThousandEyes, you can check them out at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers. Sign up there for a free trial and a free t-shirt. I think it ends up the future eventually, and the question is really, what path do we follow to get there? And as operating a data center becomes a converged operation where there's far less distinction between the different components of the IT stack, and everyone's expected to work on the stack as a whole, and automation processes and workflows are built to deal with that stack as a whole, then you need an interface on the network that allows you to include it, include provisioning of it and configuration of it in conjunction with everything else that's being stood up. And that's really the challenge now is we don't operate that way in IT, you know, for the most part. There's a few select companies that do, and they really have had to integrate all parts of the IT stack and build processes around, we need this service up and running now, all parts of it. And there's no concept of creating a ticket, throwing it over the wall, waiting for the network people to get done what they need to get done. And if that takes 2 weeks or 6 weeks because of change control process, then that's okay. And because that's just the way things are. There's a few companies where that's no longer acceptable. And so they've moved ahead and created those programmatic interfaces and operating systems that support them so that they can build out that whole stack, provision it as one thing. And I think that happens for everybody eventually. And why wouldn't it be Linux? There's a really strong case to be made for that because it eliminates some of the differences between services and should make it more streamlined for your automated operations. That's my working theory anyway. But it's a trickle-down problem. Now the hyperscale people are doing it because they have those problems today. When is there an economic reason for other businesses who don't have web scale problems, but they can be motivated by money, let's say, and efficiency to take on those sorts of practices? And I don't know that engineers are going to drive that. It may be vendors that build product sets around all of these features that end up driving it. And at some point, you don't care what the network is underneath. It does what you need it to do, and you're operating the IT stack as a whole anyway. So it doesn't have to say Juniper on the front or Cisco on the front or HP on the front. What difference does it make? You bought this big stack that does all of these things, including networking for you. And you were saying earlier, Wes, that I started comparing and lo and behold, we're running the same LLDP daemon. Huh, what do you know? Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of that a lot of people are going to be asking themselves, there is no differentiation here if the end functionality is the same.
Yeah. So speaking of automation, for example, I was able to use Ansible for both my servers and my switches. Hmm. So that was good. But you know what would be better, honestly, is if I really didn't have to automate the network at all. And also if I didn't have to log into switches, and so I didn't see the Linux prompt, if I could manage my network as a fabric, not as switches, and if it would just work, right? I think there's still a lot of room. Actually, this gets back to earlier packet pushers where you guys discussed automation versus orchestration, right? Stuff like Ansible is automation. It's not orchestration. Mm-hmm. So
it's like a shovel. It's better than using your bare hands.
But, right.
Yeah.
But so and now we're seeing higher layers emerge. I mean, there have always been orchestration layers, but we're seeing there's a couple intent-based, you know, orchestration.
Abstract out there, yeah.
Blue, yep.
So I think that stuff is interesting. The other thing, you talked about configuring a service with compute and the network. The other place that we're going is with overlays now, the network doesn't really need to be configured. Yes. It's configured once.
Yes.
You know, and that's what we...
And this is what we learned from NSX, VMware's NSX, is
yeah.
If you can integrate the VM... or the container for that matter. And this is why Cisco's leaping so heavily onto containers. And they see that as the successor to the VM. And if they can control that, then they can take a strategic position to outclass VMware. But if you can integrate the network like NSX does with the vSphere ESX hypervisor, then you actually don't need to configure the switches because it's being pre-configured for you in the hypervisor itself.
Right. And so you end up with basically you just configure your network one time. You just need to set the subnet for each rack. And after that, pretty much it just runs.
Mm-hmm.
And that become that's really I think that is a very real way to look at things. For those of us, those of you listening to Packet Pushers, it's the underlay. You build a simple underlay that's L3 and put all the fancy stuff into the overlay, you know, at the edge. Whatever you can argue about efficiency being lost because it's an overlay encapsulated packet, blah, blah. I don't think that really matters in the grand scheme of things. I think I used to think that, but I've kind of come around on that. And then the underlay doesn't change that much. It doesn't have to. It stays simple and predictable.
The critical thing to realize here is that if you're going to build an NSX or an overlay network of any sort, don't confuse your legacy network with this network. These are two separate networks. The physical networks have completely different requirements. Your new overlay network will have switches that you configure once, close them off. You can probably solder up the console ports, you know, up to a point, like conceptually, and you will never need to talk to them again. So don't try and say, well, oh, but my overlay has to use the same switches. No, just keep them completely separate. That's your legacy. It's over there. That's where your spanning tree is, and that's just leave that there, right?
Well, that's where the pod concept comes in.
Yeah.
And people talk about this, but I don't know if everybody really gets it, that to me, one of the core things about the concept of the pod is that each pod can have different technology inside it. And, you know, you need some standardized border, but definitely if you're standing up like a new, like a private cloud or a virtualization environment or a hyperconverged environment, you know, put that in a separate area, put in different switches that are optimized for that, which, as you said, may be just very simple functionality, just configure once.
Yep. Optimized might mean cost optimized, feature minimized, you know, high performance. And, so they're 25 gig and 50 gig.
Performance maximized, right?
Yep.
Get that 40 gig out, you know, go to 100, you know, 25, 50, 100.
Buy expensive NICs instead of expensive switches. You know, get yourself some Mellanox or some Netronome or, you know, those.
So we are seeing, I think, a shift, at least in my mind, from the switch to the NIC, because this goes with the hypervisor now, right, is controlling everything with the overlay. The intelligence is in the hypervisor, and then it can offload some of that to the NIC. So the NIC now matters.
Yeah. Yeah, we did some testing with a customer, and they found that the onboard NIC on an Intel motherboard caps out at around about 9.5, 9.6 gigabits per second. And then if you start doing TCP offload and stuff like that, they actually, the performance drops way down, 8 gigabits per second. But if you go and get a high quality one from, say, somebody like Mellanox or one of the other vendors, you can actually get like 9.9 gigabits per second across the bus without, and burning less than 5% of one CPU core. So there's a massive difference between not, you know, the NIC that comes for free on the motherboard. It's free and it's crap. Don't use it, is my advice to be.
Yeah. Now, the good news is because, you know, all the NIC vendors see that that functionality is needed. So that functionality is trickling down. And with 25 gig, the NICs are a lot better. So a lot of what you might call a basic 25 gig NIC has a lot of more advanced functionality that you might have called a smart NIC in the 10 gig world, to the point that you may not need to buy a really expensive high-end NIC, but it also depends on the software. We're now in a situation where the NICs are so complex that basically the NIC comes out and the driver, there's a working driver on day one, but it can send packets, you know. And then over the next 2 years, you see the driver be enhanced to support all the functionality of the NIC. So you have to be a little bit careful that you may buy a NIC that has certain functionality, but the driver may not have that functionality turned on yet. But I think that's going to mature over time.
Yes.
You know, some companies are more mature than others because they're on their nth generation. You know, basically companies will do, you know, N generations, and then at some point they'll have so much legacy that they'll decide to completely redesign it. And that actually puts them a couple of years behind, you know, as they have to rewrite all the software until they catch up again.
But I mean, the edge is shifting as well. I mean, a lot of these, like we talk about specialized NICs, they hook into OVS, and that's what the drivers were written for. But not everybody's necessarily using that. Well, okay, some people are doing a Contrail. They're doing open Contrail. And so since we got enough people that'll buy a NIC that is optimized for that environment, we'll move towards that target and, you know, and so on. It's so fluid right now.
It is, although I definitely see the most support around OVS. I think, you know, you couldn't go wrong there. But we're seeing new things emerging. XDP is a hot topic. It's still very early in development in the Linux world, but it's pretty cool. We're seeing some people are still trying sort of software onloading approaches, like VPP came out, ironically, from Cisco. They decided to open source it after developing it for many years. It's very high performance software forwarding. So you could dedicate one core of your server, use VPP, and you'd get good performance, or you could get a NIC and do offload onto the NIC with OVS. Yeah. So there's a lot of different approaches out there.
People are getting into XDP now, which uses and talking about how using XDP and Linux can really accelerate the performance of software-based forwarding.
I think the stuff that was happening with DPDK and then with VPP, which is built on DPDK, but it has some really cool optimizations to make it incredibly fast.
Yeah.
Basically, they kind of embarrassed Linux. You know, it was like people thought, you know, Linux got up to like, oh, it could do 10 gig routing. People were like, yeah, that's pretty good, you know. And then this other stuff came along and they're like, oh, yeah, we can do 100 gig, 200 gig routing, you know, in software. And that made Linux actually look pretty slow. And so the Linux people were like, we're going to fix this.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to create XDP. We can do a much better job
and use BPF. And then, so what I hear now is XDP came from PlumGrid, if I remember rightly. And then Cisco had VPP for the lookup tables for it. And so Cisco acquired PlumGrid when they went under. So I think now you're going to see VPP, which is going to give you your table lookups, running on XDP, which is going to do your networking code, running on BPF in Linux. So all of that runs in user space. So it doesn't interrupt the CPU and it doesn't need kernel approvals and all that. And it's just hugely, hugely fast. And it's actually three separate projects coming together. And interestingly, Cisco probably is going to control the networking stack inside of Linux in the end.
They may. I just want to throw in one nit there. A cool thing about XDP is it is actually in the kernel, but it's a safe way to put code in the kernel. It's kind of like, it's a bytecode. It's kind of like Java bytecode in the sense that it's safe bytecode. So you can load kernel code, but it's guaranteed to be safe. And so you get all the performance advantages of being in the kernel, being able to tap directly into a device driver.
Okay, right.
But at the same time, it's safe. So that's a pretty cool thing.
We're taking a quick break from the show to talk about ManageEngine Firewall Analyzer. Firewall Analyzer is log analytics and configuration management software that supports over 50 different firewall appliances, and there is no agent required. With Firewall Analyzer, you centrally collect, archive, and analyze security device logs, and then generate forensic reports from that information. In other words, Firewall Analyzer is the tool you use to make sense of the endless piles of security data your firewalls are sending you. If you're like me and you like to crank up the detail level on your logs so that you have absolutely all the information, you end up with far, far more stuff than you can actually deal with by yourself, and you need a tool to help you. With ManageEngine Firewall Analyzer, you can automate compliance audits using built-in reports for regulatory mandates such as PCI DSS, ISO 27001, SANS, NERC, CIP, and NIST. You can also get an audit trail of all changes done to your firewall configuration using change management reports. You can monitor network traffic and receive instant notifications during spikes in bandwidth utilization. You can quickly search the logs and pinpoint the exact log entry at the root of the security event that you're investigating. Does that all sound interesting? Well, you can find out more about ManageEngine Firewall Analyzer by visiting www.fwanalyzer.com/packetpushers. One more time, that's www.fwanalyzer.com/packetpushers. If you head up there now, they will give you a free 30-day trial.
There's been a lot of talk about user space networking and about how it's so fast. And actually, user space, kernel space, there's no performance difference there, really. The real difference that is there is whether you're polling the NIC or waiting for interrupts. And a lot of these user space packet processing software, it uses polling, and that's where the true performance comes from. So I think really what we should talk about is polling-based networking versus interrupt-based, where Linux traditionally was interrupt-based. Some of the stuff like DPDK is polling-based. That's where it gets the performance. That's why it's faster. But the downside is it sucks up a whole core. This is why it does not scale down to things like a desktop PC or a cell phone, right? Which is actually the largest market for Linux is now phones, Android phones. And so Linux was a bit constrained by the fact that it wants to run on everything from these tiny IoT devices, cell phones, PCs, up to servers and routers and switches. And so they couldn't specialize the network stack just for one of those.
Yeah.
But now with BPF, they're starting to find a middle ground that doesn't hurt the existing network stack. It doesn't hurt the ability to run on all these devices, but it does allow these really high performance optimizations.
Let's talk about ASICs. You've been close to the ASICs. You've known what the vendors, and we've been pretty much stuck with Broadcom and whatever they chose to give us, which wasn't much for quite a period of time. And yet in the last, 2 years, we've seen an explosion of ASICs.
Yeah, I got to say, it's great to see this competition coming out. I have definitely talked with all these companies I talked with, you know, I talked with all the NOS companies, all the white box companies, and all the ASIC companies. So Broadcom obviously is the, you know, the big daddy. And I do think they got a little bit complacent because, you know, with Trident 1, which I guess was 2010, that was their 64 port 10 gig switch. That was a line rate ASIC. Yeah. Great. Trident 2 was like 2012, 2013. That was 128 ports. So, okay, great. They doubled the performance. Oh, but it's not quite line rate anymore. For small packets, it's only like 3/4 line rate. And of course, they don't admit this, right? You have to wait for Arista to kind of launder out like, oh, by the way, the switch is not fully line rate. Hmm. And then Tomahawk is 2.5 times faster because it's 128 ports of 25 gig. But there's also other sort of performance anomalies. And then again, Broadcom doesn't really tell you about those. You have to wait for Mellanox to tell you about those.
Yeah, Broadcom keeps everything secret and covered under NDAs. And so you don't ever get specs on those switches.
Yeah.
That you can talk about in public.
Yeah. And now they have Tomahawk 2, which is 6.4 terabit. But it still appears to be based on this architecture, which is basically, I would say, IEEE and IETF protocols put down into silicon. So we have a bunch of players, basically Mellanox, who is really owns the InfiniBand market. They decided to get into Ethernet a while back. Mm-hmm. They first started off by making their NICs be dual mode InfiniBand and Ethernet, and then they started making Ethernet switch chips. So they have the Spectrum switch. Unfortunately, they're kind of one of the slowest chips on the market now. They're only 3.2 terabit. And I think also they haven't said that they have any kind of programmability. So they're going to have to make a really good showing with Spectrum 2. To kind of catch back up with the status quo.
And then we've got the Cavium X-Pliant, which is a
program. So we have Cavium, pipeline. Right. So Cavium X-Pliant, also again, it's still only 3.2 terabit, but they do, I think they were the first ones actually to release with this configurable and programmable pipeline where you can actually invent your own packet headers. Mm. You know, you're not bound to standard yes. Ethernet, MPLS, IP, VLAN, whatever, you know, headers. You can actually invent totally new packet headers if you want, and you can also invent new forwarding behavior. And their tables, they have a bunch of tables, but they're all kind of generic. So you can actually carve up the tables any way you want. So like you could say, I want to just all do IP routing, yeah. and I don't want to have any L2. This goes back to what we were talking about. If you have an overlay, you don't need yep. L2 in the switches. So just configure your switches to be all L3. And now you can carry a lot more routes. So in fact, you might even be able to use this as an ISP router.
Yeah, some of the Tomahawks and some of the Tridents do this.
You yeah, have a little what they call TCAM carving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fairly odd, but basically what it means is you allocate the TCAM. You can carve it up into chunks. I'm not going to have many MAC addresses, so I'll only allocate, you know, 8K to the layer 2 MAC table, but I'll allocate the rest to my layer 3 forwarding table or my layer 4 firewall ruling to ACL table or something like that. That's becoming right. more popular. But the XPliant, the main thing about the XPliant is, yes, it was you could do configurable, you could program it, but it was also a multi-stage pipeline and it was a recirculating pipeline. So you could actually pass the packet through the CPU, through the ASIC, and then if it got to the end and you wanted to do more functions, you could actually feed it back into the start and loop it again.
But I think pretty much all the ASICs support recirculation. People just don't talk about it that much
yeah.
because that does give you a performance hit. If a packet has to go through twice, it's now...
It's latency, yeah.
It's but well, and it's also, it reduces throughput. Like if every packet has to go through twice, now you're only half line rate instead of full line rate.
You're only 1.6 terabits. Yes.
Yeah.
There is a penalty.
So for example, I think in the older Broadcoms, if you wanted to like decap a VXLAN... and then route and then re-encap VXLAN, you had to go through twice. In the newer ones, they've improved it, so now you can do that in one pass. Yeah. But yeah, with a programmable ASIC, you can basically do anything. And I actually think recirculation is probably less needed in the programmable ASICs because you can actually eliminate all the stages that you don't That's need. Right. And then you can use that logic to do only the stages that you need. And probably what you need will fit into the logic of the ASIC.
So what do you think of Barefoot's Tofino, which is a fully, it's probably the first, you've said several times that the ASICs are basically whatever the IETF said or the IEEE said, and they've just welded that into the ASIC, whereas the Barefoot Tofino does actually sort of start from ground zero.
Right. So it's based on research from Stanford. They have some very interesting papers that were published about that. They're more open about the design. You know, they had a very good network field day set of presentations where they really went into the architecture of the chip in a way that the other vendors really do not do. Mm-hmm. And this is necessary now, because if you're going to program the chip, you need to know what's in the chip.
Well, I think customers want to know too. Increasingly, we are going to pick a switch because of the CPU that's inside it, because of the ASIC that's inside it, in the same way that you choose this server.
Well, because absolutely. Yes. That's the only thing that matters, is really the ASIC. Everything else is just, you know, sheet metal. Mm. It really doesn't matter.
Well, even things like fans and baseband management controllers and power, they're all commoditized components.
They are, yeah.
They're all the same across most of the switch vendors these days as well.
Yeah. So, and the impressive thing about Tofino, besides the fact that it's fully programmable, I mean, Cavium is also programmable, but they're 6.5 terabits. So they're actually higher performance or equal to performance to some switches that came later while still being programmable. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but is it just cool, Wes, or is there sufficient magic in the programmability, you know, having that capability that we're going to see industry adoption? And there's two flavors of that. I mean, I could see a switch manufacturer liking Tofino because it lets them put a switch that does X interesting thing to the customer for some definition of X. You know, and then the flip side is you've got customers that may decide they really want this for unique problems they have to solve today, or maybe they just want to, you know, want a future proof. But are those real? You know, are those things that right. enough people are actually going to take up on, that programmable ASICs like this are going to become a significant player in the market?
So I'm a little bit ambivalent about this. So I remember I had a vendor sales pitch from one of these vendors about their programmable ASIC, and they said, oh, you can invent your own protocols, you can do anything. And I said, well, yes, but now if I invent some new header, some new protocol, and I program your switch to do it, then probably you're the only switch that can do that. And so I'm locking myself into you, right? If I invent something that Broadcom cannot do, then, like, yeah, it's great for me to have competition for, you know, for Broadcom, but I want the ability to be able to go back if I need to.
Then we're back to where we were with the network equipment in years gone by, when they were using Z80 CPUs or MIPS CPUs, and then claimed that their network operating systems had super magic in them because they had special CPUs. It's like, it's reminiscent of the old Apple Mac OS was, you know, had super magic tragic powers because it only ran on Motorola 68000s, right?
Yeah, 68000 was great in 1978, but it lived a little bit too long. One good thing about programmability that Barefoot is talking about is using it for performance analysis and telemetry, not using it to change the forwarding. The forwarding is still probably IP. Mm. But they want to do all this fancy telemetry and stuff where they can find congestion in real time. They can tell you exactly where it's occurring on the path. They can tell you, you know, how many milliseconds each packet was queued at each switch, you know, each hop in the network. So that stuff is pretty cool. On the other hand, I don't know if people need this, because performance is so high today and it's increasing so rapidly. You know, we went from 10 to 25. We're going to hit 50 gigs soon.
I think enterprises won't. So I'll give you my two cents with, and then Ethan as well. But my take on Tofino is there's different markets for this. In the enterprise, what's going to matter is the ability to support any feature. So if you want to use an MPLS or a GRE encapsulation, or you want to use NVO3 or VXLAN or MPLS over GRE or GRE over MPLS, or, you know, God knows what other ones that are coming up. They've got Geneva, which is in the pipeline. Blah, blah, blah. You don't actually care what the encapsulation is in the data frame. Somebody's out there trying to create an extended VLAN because the current header doesn't introduce enough entropy at high speed. And if you can get into a Tofino, you actually don't care what the forwarding encapsulation is, because it doesn't matter. It can just be anything. In the Tofino, you just write a new P4 and away you go. Now, that's for the enterprise, right? I think, and that's for the people who follow the IEEE, the ITF, and so forth. But over in the cloud companies, so if you're talking about your AWSs and your Googles and your Alibabas, they want to put this telemetry in as part of the debug. They want to know if there's a performance problem in the path. For them, they might have 50,000 VMs experiencing a problem, and it's in the network, but they've got no way of knowing. So turning on the telemetry features becomes incredibly important to that market. Does that make sense? So I think the programmability means different things for different people, and the chip can be applied to a wider spectrum. And that's why I'm more interested in Tofino as a product than I am anybody else's silicons, because it's going to solve the widest use of widest number of use cases, which ultimately defines the price of the chip that they can manufacture. The more they can manufacture, the cheaper the chip, the more likely they are to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely merit to programmability, but we'll have to see how it plays out. And I like your point about not doing non-standard things, just doing future standards that weren't known when the chip was designed. Because yes. I definitely agree that most people are going to stick to standards, but having a chip that can be upgraded to new standards is valuable.
Yeah. To support Trill or FabricPath or PBB or...
But that's not a
you
new...
You know, shortest path.
That's not a new feat. I mean, we've had programmable chips that can do this right along. And what I hear from manufacturers of, I guess you'd call them an NPU, perhaps, but programmable in some level is it's been hard. Yes, it's programmable, but it's really hard to actually make the changes required to support new formats. So I guess the next question, Wes, I don't know if you've got an opinion on this, but does P4 change the game there?
I actually did a little bit of programming on IBM used to have a network processor. Back in 2002, we did a little programming on it. And yes, it was very difficult. So I agree with you there. I think P4 is a good thing. I haven't actually looked at it in too much depth, but a lot of network processors in the past were programmed in assembly language, and it was pretty weird assembly language too. Whereas,
that hurts just thinking about it.
Barefoot, yeah, Barefoot has created this language, right? P4, and if you look at the sample code that they've put out there, it doesn't look too bad. You know, it looks like you can do fairly simple things in fairly small lines of code, like 50 or 100 lines of code. So they're definitely thinking about the ecosystem. It's not just like, here's a chip, it's programmable, but it's impossible to program, right? It's like, we actually thought about how to program it.
You're echoing something that I've heard before, which is programmers that get a look at P4 go, oh, this is better. So that's encouraging. And so maybe there really is a change there. It gets easier to consider programmability for the chip in this way and make it a real thing as opposed to, yep, we can do it. We never will because it's too hard, but you could.
Right.
So finally, the last chipset that we'll talk about is the Innovium Teralynx, which was just announced. It's still a year or two away from shipping, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's interesting because it's, you know, the Broadcom team or some of them left, started their own company, and they decided to kind of reboot the architecture. They say it's more programmable, although they haven't given really any details to the public. But the headline feature is they're twice the speed that other chips are claiming. They're 12.8 terabit. And that's pretty impressive. You know, even a year out, I think in 2018, I think 12 terabit is going to be pretty impressive. It's kind of interesting.
My understanding of it, to get to 12.8 terabits, what they did was took basically four 3.2 terabit chips and put them onto a single ASIC.
Well, no. So all of these ASICs have multiple like cores or quadrants in them. Mm. Like I'm pretty sure that the Barefoot Tofino also has four quadrants. Mm. But inside they have some magic. I'm not a chip designer. I'm not going to even try to explain it.
Yeah,
that it really does. It's really a single chip, and it really is, you know, 12 terabit.
But they don't do programmable. They have sort of like the ability. There's like a hardwired forwarding plane, but only a small percentage of packets can actually be popped up for independent processing.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, right? Is like, do you want something that's twice as fast or something that's future proof, right?
Yes,
that's going to be where customers
and they also
will have to make
emphasize their lower latency. Tofino has to do all of that processing. They claim they've got X number of nanoseconds greater performance. I think this, you know, there's a, you know, one's a racehorse and the other one's a workhorse. And I think it's going to be, as you say, a question of which one's going to be there.
I don't think nanoseconds matters. You know, if it does, you should be using InfiniBand and not even using Ethernet.
Mm. And your app should be running RDMA and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. But, you know, just the fact that they're claiming to have this very high performance is impressive. I think there's another problem that's coming up, which is a little bit interesting. It was kind of unforeseen, is these ASICs are now too big for TORs because they now have so many ports that you actually literally can't fit all the ports in one U.
Yes, they're all 2U, aren't they? Yeah.
Fan-out cables for the win.
I have a feeling a lot of people are going to end up using cut down versions of these because they all offer smaller ones, right? So like Innovium has a 12.8. They also have a 6.4. They also have a 3.2. They have these cut down versions.
Yeah. One's and for likewise, top of rack and the other ones are for spines. The Tofino has a 6.5 and a 3.0.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how cheap are the cut down versions? If, you know, if those are the ones that people are mostly using, the big switch chips do help you if you're building like a chassis or something. That chassis can have fewer ASICs inside it, which reduces cost. That's a big thing that Innovium talked about is how to get, you know, 12 terabits, you'd have to use either a whole bunch of ASICs or you can use one of theirs. And likewise, if you want, you know, paid a bit, you need a lot fewer ASICs if each ASIC is faster.
Yes, that's
right. So that makes sense.
But then you've got a whole bunch of metalwork to get the ports in and out of the ASIC. So you could go back to the old CAT 6500 design back in the mid-90s where you had a switching module in the center blade and all of the other blades were actually really cheap, passive, and the whole chassis basically existed to get the port density down to the switching ASIC on the supervisor module.
Well, yeah, so you may see something like that. So for example, right, a small chassis, like a backpack, from Facebook, right? It's only four blades. It's 128, 100 gig. Soon you may see, you know, a single ASIC feeding something like that.
And that's a very cheap design because the magic goes into the backplane. You just have this fancy backplane which can get a lot of ports down it. Whereas the current backpack basically has ASICs on every line card. And in fact, I think the current backpack is actually
12 ASICs.
Yeah.
Because it's actually not a switch. It's actually 12 switches in one box. This is easier to manage, they claim. I don't know how, but yeah. So we may see, you know, pretty big physically switches with tons of ports that are really just like one ASIC inside.
And that would actually go back to where we were in the, you know, late 90s, mid 2000s in switch design, which would be interesting. It's the tick-tock. It just happens to be a 15-year cycle, 10-year cycle.
You know, cabling is a huge problem in data centers. Having a lot of cables, there's this tension because Twinax cabling is cheaper, but it's really fat. It's really evil to wrestle with, you know. I did Twinax actually from my tours to my spines because they were close together. It was a small network. And so the spines had tons of these Twinax cables coming out. It was actually very difficult to route. Fiber is much easier to work with, but it costs more. And when you have switches with hundreds of ports, it's hard to work with.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge as well. I hadn't thought about the cabling side, but that's the point. Even in a chassis, if you're running coax, but you're not going to be running coax out of a chassis. You're going to be running fiber because it's going to be a certain distance away. It's going to be longer than 5 meters.
Right. I mean, you probably aren't going to have like hundreds of things that are all within 5 meters because physically that just doesn't make sense. So if you have hundreds of ports, probably all those ports will be fiber.
Well, Wes, we have to wrap this show up. This has been a fantastic discussion. What a privilege it has been to talk with you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you guys.
Yeah. I think we've got some more topics we want to talk about, so maybe we can get together again and record another show that we'll publish out in a few weeks' time. Would that be okay?
I'm available to you guys. I love the packet pushers.
Good.
You're very kind.
Because the topic we didn't get to, I definitely want to talk about, so that'd be good.
Okay. So
to be continued.
To be continued. So first of all, Wes, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, so again, I'm Wes Felter. I am WMF. On Twitter. My blog is at blog.felter.org. You can find me on the LinkedIn if you want to offer me a job. That's about it.
That's about it. And you're currently underemployed.
Yeah. I'm on sabbatical from corporate life.
There you go. And of course, this has been the Packet Pushers as always. Ethan and I are both can be easily reached via packetpushers.net. Thanks very much to Wes for coming on the show. And after we've been going hammer and tongs at each other on Twitter and in blog comments for the last, 4 or 5 years, I guess. It's so great to be able to talk to you and just have this open discussion. And thanks very much for putting up with us. As always, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn. Like us on Facebook and rate us on the iTunes. And last but never least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.